We're ready for 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. You may remember from our last study that Paul was talking about examples or illustrations. He went back to Old Testament Israel. He talked about some of the things that they did. Often he mentioned some bad things that they did, and we are to learn from what happened to Israel so we don't commit some of those same errors. Then we get down to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12, and he says, drawing a conclusion, wherefore or therefore, let him that thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. When you see therefore or wherefore in the Bible, it's always telling you that a conclusion is at hand. Paul, in this case, is drawing a conclusion about salvation. He says Christians can stand, that is, they are able to remain in a saved relationship with God, or they are able to fall, that is, they can forfeit, they can lose their salvation. When he uses that word stand, that is not only a verb, it is a perfect tense verb, and it means to stand, it means to be firm, it means to resist. When you think about someone resisting or standing firm, what comes to mind? When will people stand fast or resist?
Well, we saw a lot of that on the university campus this weekend.
Sure. You find protesters, the police might show up, but if they are dedicated to the cause, it's we're not going anywhere. We're going to sit down, we're going to lock hands, we will lie down, we will do virtually whatever it takes. I mean, some people have glued themselves to the street. I mean, that's incredible that people will do that kind of thing, but people will do that because they want to stand firm. They want to resist. So that's one great illustration. Where else do we see that? How else do we see that? People stand firm or resist. All right. There's typically some conviction that people have, and they're going to hold on to it. They're not going to give in. We see that from the world, but sometimes you don't see that coming too well from Christians. People can, for whatever reason, they can have their feelings hurt, but you really don't see that sometimes with protesters. People can say bad things. They can throw things at them. All kinds of injuries, might be potential problems, and yet they do stand fast. Well, when Paul says that you need to take heed lest you fall, he is telling us that apostasy is possible. There are a lot of passages in the Bible which talk about the possibility of apostasy. One source has estimated that there are at least 2,500 different warnings against falling away. I've never tried to count them up, but that certainly would be a bunch. And passages, Galatians 5:4 is always an easy one for me. Paul talked about being severed from Christ. Saw somebody on Facebook not too long ago, didn't know him, just saw a random post. The person was saying that you can't fall away from Christ. Apostasy is impossible. I never got a reply back, but I simply made the point. If you sever something, what first must be true?
Must be connected.
All right, it's got to be connected. And if something is connected and it is severed, then what must be true?
It's no longer connected.
Well, if you are severed from Christ, then what would be true?
You were
once connected, and if you're severed from Christ, then you are no longer connected. And if you are no longer connected to Christ, are you saved or lost? You are lost. So it's kind of 1, 2, 3, and that lays it out pretty well, but the person simply chose not to respond. A little bit more. When you look at the word 1 Corinthians 10:12 that is translated fall, it describes not just a fall, but it describes an unintentional fall. That's significant too. What comes to mind when we think about an unintentional fall? Yeah, here's a person who trips, here's a person who stumbles, maybe ends up in the ER. They had no, that was the last thing that they had on their mind that day, but they unintentionally fell. What else? An unintentional fall. Do you see that in the spiritual realm sometimes? An unintentional fall.
You go in trying to teach someone with good intentions, and they end up teaching you.
That happens sometimes. Here is a person who has, as Tracy said, here's a person who has good intentions, trying to convert someone, and they're the one who leaves the truth and goes into error. What about people in some organizations? What about police? Do you think police fall sometimes? They're out there dealing with criminals?
Yes.
And all kinds of bad folks?
Yes.
And eventually what happens?
They
get involved with the crooks. They become a criminal themselves. So it is possible for people to unintentionally fall, and that's true for us as Christians. We might have good intentions. There have been, for example, some church leaders who have been involved with people, counseling situations, and they ended up committing sexual sins. So a lot of different possibilities there. Under the Old Testament, do you think that God's people intended to fall?
No.
I mean, they come out of Egypt, they're being cared for in the wilderness, and when they've got kings, I mean, they're assuming that everything is going to be fine, everything is going to go great. They did not plan on destroying themselves. They had no plans to enter into apostasy, and yet that is exactly what happened. Rarely do people think that they're going to fall. When you see the person, it's like People, maybe you've done this, maybe not, but you're in an area which isn't like New York, but I mean, it's not like you're out on farmland either. You're in a public area, you're on a public sidewalk, and there's a little traffic. You ever see somebody, they're walking down the sidewalk, they're thinking, okay, not too many people out, I've got an important text message, I'm, you know, scrolling this, you know, looking at this, that, or the other thing. What happens? Well, yeah, it might be we're connecting with the light pole, or they run into somebody else. Hopefully, they don't step out in front of traffic. But that happens. Why? They never intended to hit the car. They never intended to stumble into another person. They didn't intend to hit the lamppost, but it was an unintentional collision. So rarely do people think that they are going to fall. People, for the most part, think that they're going to stand. They feel secure. They feel confident. They don't really sense any kind of threat. And that's how Israel went through life. Christians need to be confident in their relationship with God. John talked about that in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. But we do not want to be cocky. There are people, though, who become smug. They become overconfident. And that makes them susceptible to apostasy and condemnation. Notice that when you look at that word, which is translated think, it is a present tense verb. Therefore, let him that thinks, ongoing action, thinks he's going to stand. What's that tell you about the attitude of the person? He believes, ongoing action, he's not going to fall. He has too much confidence. So good confidence is right, but you can be cocky, and that is not a good thing. So Paul says, take heed. That is also a present tense verb. We saw it back in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 10. Do you think that Satan can use a lack of spiritual alertness to get a person? He can, and that is a real problem for us. People can become so involved with other things, so consumed with other items, that they simply don't pay attention. This is a great weapon for him. Too many people have said, this is never going to happen to me, and yet it has. Anything you want to add or ask before we move down to the next point? Okay, let's go down a little further. With the Corinthians, we talked about this in a previous class. Idolatry was one of the big problems at Corinth. We saw this in our last discussion of this particular chapter. And it looks like the Corinthians were thinking, we are in this culture, idolatry. We came out of that. And we know that that's still something that exists. But we like what was taking place over there in the pagan festivals. I mean, it was a fun time. There was good food. And we think that we can go over there and be part of that. But what are we not going to do? Just like people today, Christians will look at an activity. Maybe somebody says, we're going to have a party to a teenager who's a Christian. We're going to have a party over at our house on Friday night. And the Christian who hears that, the young person thinks what? There's going to be what there? There's going to be some booze, and there might be some drugs, and there might be some fornication. I know that, but I like the people. I want to have a good time. Don't have any other plans on Friday night. So what's my approach going to be? I'm going to go, but I'm going to keep it clean. Do you think the Corinthians could have had that same kind of reasoning when it came to the pagan temples? We're going to go. We're going to have our friends there. This is going to be a great time. We're just going to, you know, kind of stay on the outside of the perimeter and not really get close to that. And Paul is warning these people, you do not do that. The Israelites tried that kind of stuff. They ended up being in fellowship with the pagans, and that got them into great trouble. Remember Solomon's counsel back in Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 18? What goes before destruction? Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before the fall. Christians today need to be wary of that. They need to avoid environments which can put them in a situation where they're going to fall. I remember, and I've used this illustration a couple times before, but I was in scouts with a man who was talking about, he was married, talking about different women, and he said, I look, but I don't touch. Well, he was, and he ended up getting divorced. Yep. So, I look, but I don't touch. And that did not work out very well for him. But, again, he was trying to say, I'm going to stay on the outskirts. I'm not going to, you know, do anything which is going to get me into serious trouble. And that did not work out for him too well. So, be careful. If you're thinking, I'd never behave like that, Paul says, let this be a warning to you. You can fall into sin. Okay. If you remember back as far as some of the material in the previous chapter, Paul said that the Christians were in a race, and that's certainly true for us. Athletes, if they're going to compete in a race, do they need to be concerned about the way they compete?
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to run that race, if you're going to participate in athletics, it's kind of like driving. You need your full concentration. You need to be fully engaged in the race. What about the athlete who says, I'm going to go in there and win? Professional athlete, or even someone who's a student athlete in high school, maybe even in junior high era. I'm going to go in there, I'm going to be the best wrestler, I'm going to go in there and be the best runner, I'm going to go and be the best, you know, soccer player, whatever. I'm going to win, our team's going to win. Are there some people who do that? Football team gets them all worked up, the coach back in the locker room, you guys are going to go out there and cream them, right? Well, guess what? It doesn't always work that way. Oftentimes, overconfidence is the downfall for people, and Paul is warning us when it comes to that in the spiritual realm. Engage in self-examination, 2 Corinthians 13:5. Do not be like Israel. We want to be watchful. Anything that you want to add or ask based on what we've said so far? Okay. Let's pick up a well-known verse. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. Here Paul says, "There is no temptation which has taken you, but such as man can bear." We've seen in the previous verses, Paul has all these warnings about Israel and how they fell, and we don't want to commit that same error. Here he offers some potential encouragement. He also asks the question, what if Christians are so tempted that they cannot resist turning from Christ? He knew that that could be a potential issue for the Corinthians. When you hear or when you see that word temptation, what's it remind you of? What's it sound like? What's a temptation?
Opportunity.
I'm sorry?
An opportunity.
All right, it's an opportunity. We could expand that definition a little bit. It's an opportunity to do something, and that something is what? All right, it's an opportunity to sin. Here is an opportunity to break, to violate God's law. We know that temptations can come in a lot of different ways. They can be mental. You may not actually do anything. It is a mental temptation. There would be some other temptations which would fall into the more literal category. They would be physical. There are temptations which would be spiritual. There are temptations which are financial. There are temptations which would be categorized as religious. And there are also temptations which would fall into the social category. When we think about temptation, there is a broad range. Just about anything in life can somehow be turned into a temptation. You may remember in James chapter 1 and verse 2, James says that temptations can be manifold. They can take all kinds of different forms. Paul associated with temptation with earthly wealth, 1 Timothy 6:9. Jesus associated temptation with prayer. And you might think, well, prayer, you know, how can that be associated with temptation? Well, it was for the disciples. So virtually everything, anything in life, it can be used by Satan somehow as a temptation. We'll just stop there for a second. Nick?
I'm going to say also, if Satan finds that one temptation isn't enough, he may compound it for you.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, they can make up some really some marvelous scenarios.
Yeah, and that can take a couple of different forms. It could go that way, or if it looks like one is working, let's just increase that. I mean, if one is hurtful, let's add five or let's add ten that are related. And we'll hopefully beat the person down to the point where they finally succumb. Some temptations from things that are good or right. Can you think of some? Okay, I'll give you an illustration. But temptations coming from things that are good or right or maybe even scriptural. Here's one, for example. A person helps someone. Is that right? Is that a good thing to do to help somebody?
Yes.
Sure. But can that be a temptation?
Yes.
How?
You might have some. You might find yourself having some expectation of return.
All right. Here's the person. Well, you know, I did this for you, and it really wasn't out of the goodness of my heart. I'm going to. And maybe you didn't have that.
Maybe it was.
It was initially. It wasn't that.
Now I need something.
Now I need something. And what I need is 10 times greater than the help that I gave. So there can be that. That's true.
True story. Another congregation. We had a man that helped with benevolent acts. He started helping a family end up adultery with the woman that had the children that he was trying to help. It was just a really simple.
Yeah, where something starts is not necessarily where it stops.
It was the best of intentions.
Yeah.
It ended horribly.
Yeah, and that happens a lot of times. Here's another one, and then Gary will take your hand. What about someone who helps someone? Again, going back to that. How might that be used as a temptation the way time? Oh, Gary, you're going to answer the question. I thought you were going to give me an illustration.
If they brag about it.
Yes. Okay, that's exactly the right answer that I was looking for. Here's someone who brags and boasts. Look, you know, I've helped him, I've helped her, I've helped all kinds of people. And they brag about that. So that becomes something that was good turned into something evil. Anything else come to mind as far as a temptation that, again, it's noble at the beginning and it's bad at the end, Teresa and then Gary?
I think anything we do to help someone, if it makes you feel really good, it should. But we also need to make sure we're giving God the glory. And we're supposed to, he said, serve one another. And so that's what we're doing. I'm not accepting anything from it.
Yeah, stay in your lane, so to speak, spiritually.
It's because God is
Yeah, even telling someone that you're praying for them, can that be a bad thing?
If you don't do it.
Sure, that qualifies. But you can take that and make that into an awful thing. You can make that bad. Gary?
For prayer on your own, you could either pray for something greedy, or if you're doing a public prayer, you can try to be overly flowery in your language and show off and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Jesus talked about that in Matthew chapter 6 as far as the people. They were really great when it came to spiritual showmanship. And Jesus said, that just will not fly with God. Very good. So a lot of things, virtually everything, as I said, you can somehow turn it into a temptation, or the devil can flip that around and turn that into a temptation for us. When we think about the word which is translated temptation, it is capable of three meanings here, of course. The meaning is a temptation to sin. Does God ever tempt us in that sense? Does God ever tempt us to sin? No. James makes that clear. All temptation is either going to come from a desire that we have. Ultimately, of course, that's probably going to be traceable back to the devil. Paul said that God's not going to allow, he's not going to permit a temptation that's too great for his people to withstand. And this is kind of where things get interesting. It is as if God has set some fixed bounds for the devil. Now, thankfully, Job, when you look at that book, there are about 40 chapters there. And you see, especially when you look at the first chapters, that God has put some restrictions on the devil. And those restrictions, depending on how you look at it, may seem pretty stringent, or they may not seem too stringent. On the one hand, the devil was not able to take Job's life, and the things that Job went through, they were restricted. Some people think that he faced those problems for less than 6 months, which was plenty long as far as all the things that he went through. But, it was not for a lifetime. And then his restoration at the end of the book was certainly a wonderful thing for him. But that kind of sets the stage for what we have here, that you find that the devil does have some limitations when it comes to tempting God's people, 1 Corinthians 10:13. Peter, 2 Peter 2 and verse 9 said, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation. That's a good cross-reference. And to keep the unrighteous under punishment under the day of judgment. So Peter also, it's not quite a parallel thought, but it is certainly in the same general category, says something similar. When you think about this, I'm going to give you a little bit of a quote here. Paul's readers may have understood God's promise to limit temptation against the background of ancient athletic contests. In the first century, athletic officials did not allow entrants to compete indiscriminately or by chance. But after careful examination of their physique, and age, they joined them up in proper pairings, for example. Boys with boys, men with men, pairs who are alike in age and strength. So we must understand that divine providence arranges with most righteous care all who enter the contests of this life, taking account of each other's virtue. This is known only to providence or to God, who knows the hearts of men. Thus one person fights against this kind of flesh, another against that kind, one for this length of time, one for that. One is goaded by the flesh into this act, another into a different act. One resists this hostile power, another that, and a third, two or three together. But God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your own strength. That is to say, individuals are tempted in proportion to the degree and virtue of the strength. Now, that's a lot there, but if you boil it down, it's basically saying this. God looks at you and says, all right, I understand everything about you. You're a Christian. You're trying to do what's right. I know what temptation would destroy you spiritually. I know what is too much for you. It's almost like a parent looking at a child. If you have a three-year-old and you have some barbells and you have a 100-pound dumbbell there, and the three-year-old says, I want to go pick that up. Well, as a parent, what are you going to say?
I would say go ahead.
Okay. Well, they could try, obviously. I was looking for a different answer. I was looking for you just want to play with me. Thanks, Chris. All right. You would say, look, that's too heavy for you, okay? That's not a plaything. The day may come when you can use that, but right now, that is not for you. And that's what God does when it comes to temptation for us. He says, devil, that's too much for him. Now, it would be nice if God simply said, devil, you can't tempt them at all, but we don't get off the hook quite that easily. So God does proportionally somehow regulate temptation and does limit the devil. Anything that you want to add or ask along those lines? Okay, a little bit more as far as proportional temptation. Will that mean that we are victorious over every temptation?
No.
No. We are still going to struggle, and there are going to be some times where we do fail. But it does tell us that we at least potentially have the ability to deal with and to overcome that temptation. But, of course, we sometimes fail to find the way out, or we sometimes just, you know, give in to the sin and fail. Now, an additional thought or two that we can make there, if we are victorious over temptations, and we should have those victories from time to time, does that necessarily mean that the victory is going to be swift?
No.
If we're dealing with temptation, that might be a protracted thing. That might be something which is extended out over a long period of time. Does that mean, as far as God's promise here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13, that the solution for temptation to overcome it is going to be simple? No. It may not be swift. It may not be simple. Might it be pleasurable? Probably not. I mean, it could be, but the chance of that's probably close to zero. And it's maybe not going to be easy to see. You find sometimes people have a problem and they're struggling with it, and they say, I just don't see any way out. And temptation can also come to us in that form. When you look at a previous chapter in this book, back in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 7, Paul says, each man has his own gift from God. Now, he's kind of talking about a different thing there as far as sexual self-control, but it is a somewhat similar thought that, again, God recognizes that we all have strengths, we all have weaknesses, and he works with those to make sure that the set of temptations that we are stuck with, that those are appropriate for us. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 17, too, you have the expression distributed to each one. That tells us that God is actively involved in our world, monitoring all kinds of things, helping people in various ways, and he does stand by to help us during difficult times. God is the deliverer rather than the tempter, James chapter 1, verses 13 through 15. Now, if you think about ancient Corinth, it could be compared to places like modern New York or Chicago, a large city. Paul certainly would have known those kinds of things. He would have known that temptation was close by for the Corinthians, not only because of where they live, but because of the background that they come from. I mean, here were people, they had succumbed to the temptations. When we think about people today, as far as the unsaved, they're living the life that you would associate with heathenism, paganism. I mean, they're not necessarily involved with the occult, but they're just, you know, out at the clubs and doing the things, maybe some drugs, those kinds of things. What's, generally speaking, going to be their attitude when it comes to temptation? How are they going to respond to temptation? They're not going to see this temptation. Their main concern is what?
It feels
well, okay. Is it pleasurable? That's going to be probably number one. What might the second consideration be?
Will it ruin my reputation?
Well, they could be concerned about that. I mean, especially if they've got a good job, they don't want to. I think you see that sometimes with Christmas parties. It's going to be an open bar at some places for Christmas party, and people will think, okay, I don't want to go and get four sheets to the wind, otherwise I might lose my job. So there is some of that. Then what's the third consideration then? I don't want to get in jail, right? I don't want to be locked up for this. So if I'm not going to get locked up, if I'm not going to lose my job, and if it's going to be pleasurable, then it's good. We're fine with that. And you can see when you look at that thinking and you contrast that with the mindset of a Christian, there are two very different things. Well, let's think about this in lieu of what we saw back in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12. The Corinthians, from what we can tell in that verse, Paul said, they were thinking all things are lawful. And Paul has to say, wait a minute, even if that's true, not all things are expedient. But if the Corinthians were under that impression that every activity was lawful, what was probably going to be their response to temptation? Well, what did we just go through? If it's pleasurable, it's fine. And if I'm not going to lose my job, well, that's strike two as far as it being all right. And then if I'm not going to get locked up, if the police aren't going to come after me, then, hey, let's go. We're going to have a great time. And that, of course, would have led them to places like these heathen temples. So we can understand the thinking even though it was not right. Anything you want to add or ask? Brian?
Obviously, this is written to Corinthian Christians. Do you think that the promise applies to anyone?
As far as God delivering people from temptation?
Yeah, providing a way of escape.
I do.
And for us, Jesus is the way of escape for everybody. But with a specific temptation, you wonder how that offer is extended to non-Christians.
Oh, wait, you're asking about non-Christians.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you meant...
Does the promise apply generally to everybody?
Well, there are times where people talk about limited protection, and I would say you see that with providence. The non-Christians do get some degree of providence. We know that, for example, Jesus talked about the rain falling on the just and the unjust. God could have set up the system. I don't know exactly how it would work, but he could have set the system up where only the righteous get rain. But people share air, sunshine, a lot of God's blessings. And there would be some aspects to this. I mean, we have the ability to reason, to think. And I know with your work, you've probably seen that, especially with the Christmas parties. You've got some people who are not necessarily religious, but they've got the sense to know that if liquor is going to be served, we probably want to limit how much we drink so we don't get in trouble.
I think it would be hard to for me to understand holding non-Christians accountable for sin if they didn't have the way to teach that offered to Christians too.
Yeah. So, and they do. I mean, free will. When you think about temptation, people have free will. You have the ability to say, I'm going to make this choice, I'm going to decline this choice. So Christians and non-Christians, that would be one more way as far as a general answer or a general gift of God to people that Christians have too, but God's people have some extra things that we'll talk about a little later. That it? Okay, let's see what else we've got. Let's talk about this word which is translated ordinary. The King James translation, an older version, says common to man. You also have in the ASV the expression such as man can bear. All those renderings are based on a single word that occurs only a few times in the New Testament, and it has multiple meanings, but the idea is humanness. There are some things which are true for people who are human. Other things would be true for those who are animals, but in this particular case, we're talking about human beings. Men and women have some things in common, and one of the common points of commonality would, of course, be temptation. That's existed since the time of Adam and Eve. You can go back and read about that, of course, in the book of Genesis, and that continues to be an issue in the world, and it's going to continue until the end of time. We think about Jesus. If temptation is something that is characteristic of human beings, and Jesus came into the world and in the form of a human being, then of necessity, he had to be what?
Tempted.
He had to be tempted, and the Bible says he was. We know, for example, from Matthew chapter 4, the devil tempted him. Ask it a different way. What were some of the other temptations that Jesus faced? Devil goes after him, but how else is he tempted? All right. All that Satan does there in the wilderness. So we've got the three temptations plus some others over that 40-day period. But later in Jesus' life, how's he tempted?
Anger.
All right. People, let's just kind of take one of those at a time. They really press his buttons, don't they? I mean, people, they really frustrate him, and yet he has to give an appropriate response every single time if he's going to be the Son of God. Fear. Can you imagine going to the cross? Not trusting God? Wondering if God's going to deliver him? Temptation at the end of his life as well. Anything else when we think about Jesus and temptation?
It's been tempting when the people wanted to make him king.
Yeah, that was another one that sprung to my mind. I mean, here are people who say, we'll make you king. We're going to lift you up. We're going to make you our leader. That would be a tempting offer that some people would say, I'll sign off on that. Sure, I'll do that. What about the life that Jesus lived? You remember he had no place to call home?
The ridicule, the scorn,
all those things, the bitterness that he could have had. Can you imagine the envy or the grumbling? You start going through the list of sins in the New Testament. I mean, it's just one right after the other. Jesus faced all those things, and yet he faced them correctly. He faced them scripturally every single time. So when we're tempted, Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 says, we have a high priest that understands temptation, and that is literally true. We see that illustrated in a lot of different ways. Anything else that you want to contribute? Okay. Unlike animals that are driven by lust or creatures who fail to think about the consequences of our actions, Paul says that we can bear our temptations. Bear has the sense of withstanding temptation. Maybe you have been in a situation where someone said some things to you, maybe they pushed you, maybe they knocked you to the ground, and your immediate reaction was what? They came after you, so...
Retaliate.
All right, I'm going to retaliate. If you hit me, I'm going to hit you back just as hard. If you blacken one eye, I'm going to blacken two. If you said something nasty to me, then guess what? I'm going to really rip you up. And it happens. It's just that I'm going to ratchet this up and I'm going to respond. It's going to be the eye for the eye approach that you see under the Old Testament system. Bear is only found here in the New Testament. It means to bear patiently. It means to endure. Isn't that tough when it comes to temptation? If you're really being tempted to do something that's wrong, how do you feel? Well, let's start with the definition that I gave. Bear means to patiently endure. If you're really being tempted, let's use something that's not sinful. Anybody ever have an itch? All right, I think all of us have had an itch at some point. All right, if you are tempted to itch, do you want to bear it patiently?
Depending on where I am.
I mean, if it is a bad itch, you don't want to bear it patiently. I mean, you see people doing some crazy things in public sometimes. But if it is a bad itch, you don't want to bear it patiently, do you? I mean, if it's under the arm, you know, you just kind of want to, you know, start scratching and going right after it. And that's true for temptation, generally speaking. People don't want to bear it patiently. They don't want to endure it. They just want to get rid of it. They want to overcome it. They want to succumb to it. And then let's move on to something else. But when Paul talks about temptation, he says, I want you as a Christian to try to bear it patiently. That's tough. I mean, we would think if I've overcome I grumbled and I complained and I moaned and been dealing with this thing for a long time, and they complain about it even after the temptation is gone. But we think that we did really well. But there's a little more to it. Paul said, try to bear it patiently. That is God's ideal will. But all of us are going to find times that we've got to endure hardships, and it's very, very difficult. Anything you want to add or ask? Gary? Yes. Yeah. Even during times of temptation. So that's a great lesson as far as hymn. Temptations do serve a useful purpose. James said that in James chapter 1, verse 12. Sometimes, though, it's a little difficult to see that. All right. The basis for the Corinthians successfully overcoming temptations was God. God says to the Corinthians, to us, he says, God is what? What's that key word? 1 Corinthians 10:13. God is faithful. You have a good illustration of that in Hebrews chapter 13, and it's not an illustration based on people. It is from Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, this translation. God used 5 negative words in the original text, which means something like this. For he himself has said, and the statement is on record, I will not cease to sustain and uphold you. I will not let you down. That's a mouthful. I'll say it one more time. I will not cease to sustain and uphold you. I will not let you down. Now, if you had somebody tell you that, what would you conclude that they're trying to communicate to you? Yeah, it's about as serious as you can get. I mean, it's like somebody saying, I'm swearing on a whole stack of Bibles. And that's God's promise to us in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. I am here for you. I'm going to help you. You do need to have some faith in that, and you do have to have some part in the process. That's good news. Paul tells us in Titus chapter 1 and verse 2 that God cannot lie. 1 Corinthians 10:13 tells us that we can have success in overcoming temptations. Those are going to be kept at a tolerable level for us. You may remember from John chapter 10 and verse 27, Jesus, when he gave that discussion about his sheep, he said that he knows his people. That's good news. You do find sometimes people, they're unhappy with someone, and they say, when it comes to me, what? You don't know me. Some people would say, you don't understand me. Well, are there times where that's true?
Yes.
Sure. Are there times when that's not true, but people feel it's true?
Yes.
But God says, I know you. I understand you. There's nothing about you that I don't know. I know you better than anybody does. I know you better than yourself, than you know yourself. So, again, that's encouraging for us, and that should help us appreciate 1 Corinthians 10:13 just a little bit more. Let's see what else I've got here before we go down to the latter part of the verse. We know that God cares for the smallest of creatures, Matthew 6 and verse 36, so will he not care for us the greater? Another little key point in verse 13, we need God's help with temptation because the enticement of and from sin can do what? What's that other key word in the first part of verse 13? There has no temptation which has
overtaken,
or some translations might simply say take. That is a present tense verb, and it describes seizing someone or seizing something. What comes to mind when you hear that word seize, take? Any other words or any illustrations? You seize something, you take something. What would be another word? Okay, that's the one that I was going to... You know, somebody grabs something. It's like being out on the public street. And here's a woman with a purse. Somebody comes up and does what to the purse? They snatch it. They grab it. Well, that's the image that Paul says when it comes to temptation. It's like it grabs us. It's like it snatches us. You know, sometimes it just kind of creeps up on us. But can there be times where temptation just seems like it just pounces out of nowhere and says, bang, you know, here I am? What happens when somebody goes off on a verbal tirade? Probably not expecting that. So, first instinct's probably what? Oh, I hope you're having a nice day. Well, probably not, right? You know, if they've been unkind to you, you might feel like I'm going to be unkind back. And there has to be that mental checking of an impulse. There has to be the stopping of that. So these temptations were capable of seizing the Corinthians. And Paul uses the perfect tense to tell us that it was a problem for them in the past and that continued to be an issue. Anything you want to add or ask before we look at the latter part of verse 13? Okay. He says, here's the information about God and being faithful, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you or allow you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation make also the way of escape that ye may be able to endure it. Here's the promise, and it is a great promise. God provides a way out for his people. There is an escape during times of temptation. Now, once again, God says you're going to be able to escape. It's like maybe a prison break. Somebody says, you can get out of prison. We can get you out of prison, but it's not going to be what? It's not going to be easy. And Paul certainly does not make that promise here. When you think about Jude, this is in Jude 23. It's just the verse. There are no chapters in that book, as we know. He talks about Christians being snatched out of the fire. What image comes to mind when you hear that? Snatching somebody out of the fire. Yeah. Here's a person. There's not much time left. And you get to the person in the nick of time. And we're not talking about a literal fire there, though that has happened with people. We're talking about sin. So you have someone who's very attracted to sin, someone who has gotten involved with sin. I know I've had that situation come up. You know, I'm thinking of one case in particular. Someone talked about a person who was struggling with sin and said, I'm concerned about him. Almost like a person, let's just use suicide as an illustration. Person says, you know, I'm thinking that we need to be concerned about so-and-so. He's threatened suicide. By the time you come and talk to somebody, guess what? Might be true. It's too late. The person's already taken his life. So you really need to be cautious about some things, because when people fall prey to temptation, that can move along very, very quickly. They can succumb to it when it's especially serious. But Paul says that there is a way out. Now, having said that, might a person have some burn marks from temptation? Thinking along this line, as far as what we said about 223, if you snatch someone from a fire, what might happen? You get them out of the house, but they've been burned. They've got some scars for life. Could that take place in the spiritual realm? Yeah, they avoid the temptation, but they've been marked, so to speak. And that's perhaps something that's going to stick with them for a long time. When you think about Joseph, he was someone who escaped from temptation. Genesis chapter 39, verses 1 through 12. But how well did that work out for him, at least for a while? What happened to Joseph? Anybody remember?
He's still falsely accused.
Yeah. And did it go well for him for a while? Yeah, he ends up in prison for a little while. So things did work out. Ultimately, he made the right choice, but sometimes when we avoid temptation, it just gets to be a really bad thing. I remember, I don't know if I've ever told you this illustration or not, but there was a fellow some years back at the lectures in February, and he was talking about an older preacher who had been called to a house for a meeting. So, you know, it was just kind of common back in the day, either put you up in a motel. So they take him to the house. It turns out that the wife is the only one who is at the house. The wife decides to seduce the meeting preacher. She comes out and she says to the preacher, you sleep with me, or if you don't, I'm going to tell everybody you attack me. Kind of like Genesis chapter 39. And she said, what's your choice? Did I ever give that illustration before? Okay. All right, so here he's put in a situation. I mean, it's not just a temptation to, you know, commit fornication. I mean, it is a temptation, you know, to tell a lie. So how do you deal with that?
Find the door real quick.
Well, all right, but if you do that, then what's going to happen?
Well,
you're going to be pretty much ruined. How do you do that? I mean, 1 Corinthians 10:13 says there's a way out, right?
You just have to have confidence in the Lord that he's going to see you through.
Okay. Well, the way that he portrayed this, like, hopefully I did it in a similar way. I mean, everybody in the class kind of, you know, what would I do if I was in that situation? I mean, fornication is obviously not right, but the other door, that's not very attractive either. So after we had time to ponder that a little bit, he said the preacher fell to his knees and began to pray real hard and prayed out loud. By the time he opened his eyes, she was dressed and had come to her senses and said, "I'm so sorry." And the preacher said, "I'm going to be leaving and we're just going to consider this case closed." And that was how it ended. So I tell you that for a couple of reasons. The biggest reason being this. There are times where things come up, things happen, and it looks like there is literally no way out. It looks like it is either door A, door B, there is no door C, and there is no hope. We are just shafted. But remember, God knows the end from the beginning. He knows who we are. He knew that circumstance was going to come up. And try not to panic. I'm sure that that fella did feel some panic in that situation, but he got out of it, and there were no repercussions from it based on the description. So that's really, really important for us. We've got a lot of fiery darts from the devil. No Bible writer says temptation is easy to avoid, but faithful Christians struggle with all kinds of strange things sometimes, but we do want to remember that promise, 1 Corinthians 10:13. Anybody? Okay, let's talk about the word which is translated escape. That is a great rendering of the original term. In classical Greek, it described things like an army's exit or way of escape from a mountain pass. Now, if you can imagine that, here is the army. It is trapped. There is no way out. You're thinking, we're going to die here. Maybe they'll cut off our food supplies, and there's just no hope. But here it means God is saying there is an egress from temptation. But a lot of times I think we become short-sighted. We forget about the promise. We don't believe the promise. We kind of get back into the problem that Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. He says we're supposed to walk by what versus what? We walk by faith and not by sight. But for us, everybody, mature Christian or not, it's really easy to walk by sight versus faith. And if we're walking by sight, we might not see that temptation, or we might give in and think, okay, it's just not going to come. There is no hope. Every trial, as one said, has its own particular God-given way of escape, and that is a great, great thought. God has a lot of different ways to help his people. This goes back to the point that Brian was raising earlier. Sometimes Scripture can help us. We can call a passage to mind. There may be a Bible story that comes to mind, and that's useful. Just really strange things. I don't know if I've ever told you this illustration or not, but several years ago, we lived in a neighborhood. One night, there were a couple kids that were out. They were about 12. I don't know what was in their minds, but they got a big stick, and they came after me. It looked like they were going to try to start wailing on me. And I thought, well, that's just great. An adult being taken on by a couple 12-year-olds. I mean, you really don't want to pound the kids. That's probably not going to go over very well. And I figured I couldn't outrun them. So I thought, what do I do? I really need some help. So I thought, they're getting closer and closer, and they really kind of had that look in the eye like, we're going to have some fun now. So I thought, all right, well, we're going to try something that's a little distinctive. So I quoted the better part of John 1:1 in Greek to them. And they just looked at me. He don't look Spanish, does he? And they left. So... again, sometimes, you're looking for something which is really going to be out there as far as distinctive solution, and strange things do work sometimes, but I was thankful that we didn't have to have any kind of incident. But that word escape, God can allow some interesting things to happen. And again, every trial has its own particular God-given way of escape. If God's word is going to be used, then we certainly want that to dwell richly in us. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16, we see the effectiveness of that with Jesus, Matthew chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, and learning that word, being present at assemblies, participating, reading the Bible, studying the Bible, a lot of different tools to do that, and that's going to help us in a lot of different ways.